This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
June's Journey is a fascinating hidden object mystery gaming app where you'll play as June Parker, tasked with a daunting obligation, solve your sister's murder. Set in the 1920s, the era of glitz and glam, this family mystery is one for the ages. Everyone's a suspect until your investigation determines otherwise. The clues are all around you, hidden within tricky twists and turns. You'll collect detailed information about each character in your photo album where you'll comb over every detail. You can even join a detectives club to chat and play with others or against them in the detectives league. With hundreds of puzzles to solve, you should probably get started today. Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
This is America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network. I'm Gil Gross. When President Biden came out with his COVID recovery stimulus bill, there were two main points of controversy. The first was the size of it, with Republicans wanting to cut it in half. The second, and seemingly a main sticking point because it also concerned an important swing vote Democrat in Senator Joe Manchin, was a gradual hike in the minimum wage to $15 an hour. The received wisdom, echoed by the Congressional Budget Office, has been that though it will help many Americans, it would also cost more people their jobs. But is that true? Reports from politicians and policy institutes are usually colored by a specific viewpoint going in, which has made the work of Aaron Dubé something unique in the field because it's been based mainly on research done at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, where he's become the world's leading authority on how a minimum wage will affect the economy. So let me start by thanking you for being here.
It's great to be here.
And I should start out by saying, like many of us, you did work for minimum wage, in your case, at McDonald's. That give you any special feeling for this, or just another memory from your youth?
You know, it's a couple of interesting things. You know, of course, back then, this was late 80s, early 90s. It was actually more common for people in high school or early college to work in minimum wage jobs. It's become less common these days. In fact, nowadays, a lot more workers who are at minimum wage jobs are older, and they're going to be there for a longer period. Having said that, yes, working at a minimum wage job alongside people who were older, who were trying to support families, did give me some perspective.
So let's take a look at that Congressional Budget Office report that's been much discussed in the last week, because it says it will raise 900,000 people out of poverty. That sounds great, but it says it will do that at the cost of 1.4 million jobs. I know you think that's not right. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, so let me just begin by saying sometimes top line numbers can sound scary and big or small, but it's really useful to keep things in perspective. So according to the CBO, you're going to see wage increases that are far larger than any job losses. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. So overall, if you take the CBO's estimates seriously, it suggests that working people as a whole are substantially better off than with the higher minimum wage than not. Having said that, I do think that the CBO's estimates are more pessimistic. And here's a reason why. I actually was asked by the government in UK, the Conservative government in UK, about a little over a year and a half ago to look exactly at this question. And I provided a report for their treasury that helped them come to a determination on where to set their minimum wage, and looked at the evidence. And I found that when looking at the evidence from US, UK, other developed countries, overall, the body of research suggests a fairly muted effect of minimum wages on jobs, while significantly increasing earnings at the low at the bottom. So I think the CBO's report ends up drawing a more pessimistic conclusion because it ends up not looking at some of the more recent literature. It also ends up paying more attention to a few very large estimates of job losses. One, for example, from a study about Seattle minimum wage that subsequently has been shown to be quite problematic. In fact, the same researchers have more updated study that suggests 1/10 of the size of job loss as their original report, but that more recent estimate is not in the CBO report, while the original one is. So for these reasons, I think the CBO report ends up getting the job loss number fairly, you know, substantially too high. Having said that, I think it's important to keep in mind, nonetheless, their report can be interpreted as saying that this is overall a good policy for working Americans.
I would think there would be not that much of an effect on, say, chain fast food joints, because they would all be paying more, much as there is little effect when the price of meat or buns go up and they raise their prices. But I'm hearing a lot of complaints from mom and pop businesses trying to compete who, you know, don't open up with the name recognition of a McDonald's or a Chipotle, you know, where you open up your franchise and there's a line out the door the first day. And a lot of them say that this could be a matter of survival. Is there any research into that?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that a lot of small business owners don't fully appreciate, again, for good reason, is that when the minimum wage rises, it's not just the fact that their wages are rising and their competitors' wages are not. So there's a lot of research showing that small businesses and all businesses are able to raise prices somewhat because all their competitors are actually on the same boat. So what it means is that middle and higher income consumers end up paying a bit more, like 50 cents more on a burger. And that ends up helping raise wages at the bottom. I think a lot of intuition for how you deal with a cost increase in terms of being able to pass that on to prices for business folk come from something that happens idiosyncratically. Like, they have to do it, other people don't. But in this case, this is actually affecting the entire market. And that's why in study after study, you see a large amount of pass-through, which is an important margin of adjustment for businesses small and large alike.
So I mentioned Senator Manchin at the top, and he seemed to indicate that he could go for maybe $11 an hour. Another suggestion, if you could figure a way to do this, would be a minimum wage somehow tied to prevailing wages or cost of living in a particular region. $15 an hour might be starvation wages in New York or Los Angeles, but $11 in a small Alabama or Wyoming town where the rents are far cheaper might be a living wage. How would $11 do, and is there any way to even do something that could be regionally adjusted?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there are different ways of thinking about how to set up a minimum wage policy in the U.S. One thing to keep in mind is that we actually already have a system where minimum wages vary by area. We have 30 states that have minimums above the federal $7.25. We have over 40 major cities that have minimums as well that exceed their state minimums. So what we have is essentially the federal minimum wage setting a floor nationally. For those 20 states where basically we have never seen a state minimum wage in those places, typically in the southern states, more Republican-leaning areas, not because their voters don't like it, because every time a minimum wage is on the ballot, including in purple or red states, it passes handily. But there is reluctance on part of the legislatures and governors in some red states to actually do that. So this federal standard really should be thought of as something that other states and even localities can build off of that. $15 by 2025, by the way, would be something more like $12.75 in today's dollars. So $11 is not that far off.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. That brings up the Costco thing, which is brought up a lot when we talk about this. Some major retailers are now actually fine with raising the minimum wage based on what happened to Costco, which found that it was actually better for them, cheaper for them to pay more to get employee retention because it lowered training costs because of lower turnover and also brought more experienced people into management positions. And then people stayed with the company because they started getting invested, you know, eventually in a health plan, maybe, you know, a 401k or something, and that they actually saved by paying a bit more.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, in what we have found in our research is roughly 20 cents on the dollar, maybe of a cost increase from a minimum wage increase actually is you get back through reduced turnover and other margins. It's not to say that makes it somehow, you know, silly for employers not to raise the wage voluntarily, though in some cases, they actually could do better. What it does mean, though, is that when the minimum wage does rise, that you actually don't necessarily have to see as great a cost increase as you may otherwise believe. Let me also just say, besides Costco, just and along these lines, you see, for the first time in the last, you know, in the last 5 years, we've seen more employers of voluntary pay standards. Amazon, Target at $15, Walmart at $11, the list goes on. Clearly, they think that this is something that makes sense. And I think this is an interesting business perspective to keep in mind.
One final quick thing. One of the things unique about your studies is that you compared employment in counties that border state lines, where one state raised the minimum wage, the other did not, to see whether there was an effect. And was there?
Right. So just to clarify, we want to compare really nearby places because really nearby places often are pretty similar. So it's kind of like a lab experiment where once, you know, as if you could just randomize which county gets a minimum wage. In reality, you can, but this is as close as you can approximate it. We tracked these counties for 5-7 years after the increases. We looked at what happens to wages, turnover, employment. Here's what we found. Wages rose very quickly and stayed higher. Employment did not budge at all in restaurants, and turnover fell, showing that these jobs became somewhat better. People stuck around longer.
Aaron Dubé has done research for years on the minimum wage. She's at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Aaron, I thank you so much for spending the time. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
You're listening to America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network. Welcome back to America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network. I'm Gil Gross. As we've covered on this program, the development of vaccines has been a remarkable success. What usually takes as much as 4 years was done in less than a year. But what we've also covered is that actually distributing the vaccines has been something of a mess. In many cases, chaos, with state-to-state differences, having people running across state lines or hanging out at hospitals and drugstores near the end of the day hoping to get some leftover vaccine. Texas actually fired a doctor who gave out vaccine that otherwise would have gone bad, telling him he should have let it be thrown out rather than give it to somebody outside the first group guidelines. How has this happened and what can be done? Dr. Daniel J. Finkenstadt is an assistant professor in the Graduate School of Defense Management at the Naval Postgraduate School. He's also an Air Force major, is on the editorial board of the journal Logistics, and has spent his adult life in government acquisition and sourcing. In other words, working the global supply chain. I thank you for being here. We have had supply problems all through this thing, starting with the fact that most of our nation's need, before we even get to the vaccines, for personal protective equipment had been outsourced to China.
Yeah, absolutely, Gil. It's it has been a challenge the entire time. It has not been for a lack of effort, I'll say that. But I think that there's just been years and years of outsourcing and a lack of centralized and transparent data to allow us to react to these dilemmas and these emergencies when they crop up all at once like this.
You know, one of the things that I just thought when there was a shortage of vaccine at this period, besides the fact this is all new, they're still getting up to speed, was that there was a shortage of the vaccine itself. Then I find out, there's a shortage of vials. There's a shortage of rubber stoppers for the vials. It's beyond just vaccine.
Yeah, it's true. The fill finish capacity at these facilities has been a challenge. And a lot of folks in the supply chain have been saying that, especially people much smarter than I am in the healthcare supply chain, have been just sort of vocalizing that the entire time, which is as this comes up and as we ramp to this large capacity, you know, you've got to be able to actually get this in the vials and get it out. And that requires an entire value chain that's well behind the actual the needle itself. And it's one of the things that me and my co-authors have been trying to push, even in the phasing itself and the prioritization, which is, you know, if you worry about vaccinating the frontline healthcare worker, that makes sense on its face. But you have to think about how you replenish the stock and how do you keep it coming. And so I still have yet to see any discussion about how we're prioritizing the entire value chain up to the point of delivering the vaccine to the patient.
Yeah, and especially that last mile delivery has been a problem, in part because of the nature of these RNA vaccines that need to be deep frozen. Getting them to rural areas, Native American reservations, and then there are some parts of the country, a large part of the middle of the country, where they just don't have the refrigeration capacity in refrigerated warehouses to deal with this.
Yeah, absolutely, Gil. The the cold chain itself is very, very difficult, especially with the Pfizer vaccine. It's very sensitive to movement in and out of the casing, the way they carry it. There are novel solutions that are out there that just haven't been scaled. There's a firm, it's a joint American-German company out of their American headquarters out of South Carolina, but they're called Mecotech. And they've presented these large sort of containers that can be transported directly from the factory, where the vaccines are made, on the ships, on the planes, directly dropped into any area where they have a power source. And it can hold up to like a million vials of this vaccine and keep it at deep frozen state the entire time. But again, it's a company that's a cryogenic company. It's developed the IP and the design for it, but they don't manufacture containers. And so they have a supply chain issue just on putting that forward. So, those are the types of investments that as the vaccines coming out, we start to see which vaccine is going to be sort of our long-awaited partner. We might want to start making those investments now. I had thought that maybe that wouldn't be as important as AstraZeneca was coming online, and maybe with the Johnson & Johnson, where the temperature is not as big of an issue. But now with the mutated variants that are coming out, Moderna and Pfizer are still showing to be the most resilient to mutations. So maybe cold chain is something we have to worry about for the long term, and we need to start making those investments now.
And let's talk about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, not in any disparaging way. In fact, it looks like the solution to a lot of things. Doesn't need to be deep frozen. It's a one-shot vaccine and all of that. But it is a different kind of vaccine, which calls for different distribution. So it's good news, but it adds complexity to a system that already seems to be too complex by half.
Yeah, and it's very difficult. And this gets to, from the very beginning, and this goes all the way back to what you were talking about with the PPE issues, ventilator issues, all of that, which is just transparent data shared across the system. And it's difficult because, we had a paper come out in Milbank in 2020, where we called it, a new commons, right? This idea of there's this new tragedy of the commons that's occurring in this supply chain. And it's because everyone needs it at the same time. And you can't let market forces dictate who gets it, because there are downstream effects that can impact the people who even receive it. So right now, if you think about it, if we hoard vaccines to ourselves and don't let it get to other parts of the world, well, then those parts of the world will continue to spread, and we'll just have to keep this going. And so there's this discussion on equity, and not equity just from a pure human fairness standpoint, but like, what's the most equitable way to distribute it to reduce the spread itself as we go forward. And you add in the different types of vaccines, is it one dose, is it two dose, what's the way that we transport it. All of that needs a centralized and an integrated data tracking system using something maybe like blockchain or other distributed ledger, to where we can make sure that it's being communicated across systems and it's an immutable source of truth. Because if you look at the CDC's site right now with the various systems that they have trying to track this, you introduce yet another type of vaccine with a single versus two dose regimen or plan. And I just don't think that we've got the battle rhythm going to manage that, because, Operation Warp Speed is managing things at a federal level. But once it gets down to the jurisdiction, it's sort of the Wild West in terms of, their choice of what they want to do.
Well, and let's talk about that, because data, when people are just saying, I just want vaccine, when people are usually hearing from doctors, may sound kind of geeky. But without the geeky, the vaccine doesn't get to you. So let's talk about that, because the process for sharing data about vaccine distribution was described in one place as a convoluted Rube Goldberg machine. The CDC lists six different software systems that are being used to track vaccine distribution. The federal government tasked Deloitte with coming up with a software vaccine distribution system. It had so many gremlins in it that many states just went to their own system. So just knowing what's where has been a major problem.
It has, Gil. You know, I was actually looking at the VAM system, which is the one you're talking about that Deloitte developed. I think it was a $44 million price tag. And I think currently it's 10 jurisdictions and a few agencies are the only ones that are actually using it because it's an opt-in system and it hasn't worked very well, but it's cost a lot of money. There are other companies out there in the distributed ledger space that have created vaccine passports that work off of just QR codes. So if you can imagine, you know, the vial gets scanned at the factory floor, it gets put on a pallet, that gets scanned, you know, into the truck, it gets transported to its storage location, that gets scanned, it then gets scanned out, it gets to the hospital, it gets scanned out to the patient, and then the patient's own cell phone can scan and say, I received that dose. Why is that important? All about allocation and distribution. So Dan Fingenstadt resides in Monterey, California right now. Dan Fingenstadt is a, you know, I grew up in the Clemson, South Carolina area. I get my first dose. The state of California is allocating the second dose for me based off, you know, me being someone here in the zip code. If we're not tracking this across the system, if I have an emergency where I have to go visit family in South Carolina during my second dose window and get my second dose there, then my second dose allocation is coming to California. And they don't know why they have an extra allocation. And South Carolina is now down one allocation, and they don't know why they're down one allocation. And that may sound like not a big deal for one person, but you now multiply that by every instance across 350 million people, and it's a big deal.
We're talking to Dan Fingenstadt from the Graduate School of Defense Management at the Naval Postgraduate School, who's been making a study of not only what has gone wrong with vaccine distribution, but what still can go wrong, including not being able to prevent against both theft of vaccine and a black market of counterfeit vaccine, a problem so much a part of that world, it was the entire basis for the classic Orson Welles movie, The Third Man. That and more when we pick up this conversation in our next segment. You're listening to America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome back to America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network. I'm Gil Gross, and we're talking to logistics expert Dan Fingenstadt from the Naval Graduate School of Defense Management about what's gone wrong with the distribution of the COVID vaccine and everything that has both gone wrong and could go wrong. This inability to track exactly what's going where and who has what makes me wonder whether, you know, we might see vaccines stolen, whether there might be a black market for expired vaccine.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at what we discussed back in December when we were talking, you know, my colleague Rod Hanfield from NC State and I, we had our webinar on cold chain concerns and tracking and tracing that we've been talking about. Counterfeiting is a big deal. And if you're not tracking even the vials that this material is coming in, it is very likely that someone will get a hold of this and start creating, you know, counterfeit products. and you can't trace it back to prove that it came from Pfizer or Moderna, then you've got a major issue. Now, I don't doubt that the federal government portion of this that's managing it can verify that. But the problem is it's hitting the states, the jurisdictions, and then it's like, you know, again, it's just sort of a, you know, individual choice of how those jurisdictions want to handle it in the states. And then that's not even accounting for the fact that, you know, we have other populations like tribal populations that aren't, you know, put into the Indian, you know, into the Indian Health Services IHS system. So they're not tracking at all, right? And so there's no telling what can get spread there, which again presents a problem, because what we need right now, you know, I think in the past I've seen reported something like a 40% declination rate on vaccines, right? It was going out. I know some colleagues in Ohio were telling me that the vaccine was going out to healthcare workers there, and they were seeing like a 40% declination rate within the first phase. So people who are educated within the health system saying, I'm not taking this vaccine, right? Because it's a voluntary basis. Well, you know, Stacey Woods and some folks at NC State have written about how this is a major marketing problem, and that, you know, there's marketing things you have to consider. Well, to your point, Gil, as soon as counterfeit false vaccines that can harm you start hitting the news and in the system, that's only going to hurt that process of trying to convince people that it's worth taking. So it's absolutely vital that there's a better tracking mechanism all the way, not just from the factory to the patient, but all the way through disposal, to making sure that we're tracking when these vials are actually being tossed out and that they're not being thrown back into a counterfeit market.
Well, when we're talking about people declining to get the vaccine, let me talk to you as a major. The rate is apparently stunningly high in the military as well.
I'm not privy to the declination rate among the military. I will say that for myself here at the Naval Postgraduate School, the one thing that I saw that was a very promising, it seems very common sense, but I do know talking to other people, it's not being done elsewhere within other organizations, is the Naval Postgraduate School very early on sent out a survey to all people here just saying, would you take the vaccine if it were given? Why might they do that? Because when they're requesting allocations on something that's as sensitive within the cold chain as a Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, it is, in my opinion, it's irresponsible to just say, I have X number of members, send me X number times two vaccine. Because if you haven't just taken the simple step of asking when it's a voluntary, because it is still voluntary for the military, how many of you would take it? Then you've got a problem there, because let's say 60%, which is, you know, what, you know, so 60 to 70% is what people are reporting, you know, the national acceptance rate might be, or they have reported in the past. Let's say that's what it is. If I'm ordering 100% vaccines, that's probably irresponsible. What might be more responsible is to say, you know, if I have 100% people saying they'll take it, I'll order 100%. If I have below the 70% that we want for some sort of herd immunity, then I'll only order up to the 70%, and I'll, you know, I'll try to create an internal marketing campaign to get my people from whatever, you know, number they are below 70% to the 70%, you know. Or maybe you just say, we're only going to order for those who've agreed to take it, which both of those second options I think are more responsible than just blindly ordering 100% for everyone, which gets to your point about the incident in Texas where people are just tossing them out because not everyone's taking them.
Well, speaking of Texas, let's wrap up with this, because another segment of this broadcast this week is about the power failures in Texas. How does that add in with the needs of distribution and the needs for trucks, where there's already a shortage for truckers, but the need to keep the RNA vaccines in deep freeze? How much of a problem are power failures?
It's a huge problem, you know. It's a huge problem at every level because, again, you know, the deal with cold chain is it's not about keeping things really cold, because otherwise you'd be like, well, they've got a freezing conditions, things should be fine, right? No, it's actually in the deep freeze, it's about controlling the temperature band. So you don't want excursions too cold, too hot. You know, with power outages, you're definitely going to see them getting too warm, and with the dry ice packing that they use, you can only take things in and out and repack them a couple of times before the excursion on the temperature, you know, ruins the vaccine itself.
Daniel J. Finkenstadt is assistant professor in the Graduate School of Defense Management at the Naval Postgraduate School, obviously an expert in logistics who's been giving the story of vaccine distribution a lot of thought. I thank you so much for being with us this week.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network. This is America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network. I'm Gil Gross. Power grid problems are becoming big stories. In California in recent years, wildfires caused problems, and summer air conditioning demands led to rolling blackouts where everybody's power goes down here and there for a while to keep the system from collapsing. And now Texas is in the same boat and then some. But why? Texas set up their own closed grid, so they could not get power from other states. That's one thing, but you've got millions of Texans who are without heat and without power for days, even burning their furniture to stay warm. This was not unpredicted. Ed Herz is an energy fellow and economics professor at the University of Houston who has been predicting this failure for some time. Ed, you co-wrote a piece for the Houston Chronicle 8 years ago that said Texas suffers from Soviet-style electricity distribution system. What did you mean then, and how has it shown itself this past week?
The initial title was actually a lot shorter. It was ERCOT with the C replaced by a hammer and sickle, but the editor thought that that would be too inflammatory. So in the great rush to deregulate the Texas electricity market, much like the California market had been deregulated before, the legislature and Governor Bush and Governor Perry actually created an old-style Soviet bureau, whereby there was one purchaser for electricity in the Texas market. That purchaser is ERCOT, who acts as the market clearing agent for consumers on one side and generators on the other. As a result, the situation is such that the generators began competing hammer, tongue, tooth, and nail against each other to bid into the market on a day-ahead basis and during a real-time basis. So that over the last 10 years, while there's been a few upsets in terms of tight supplies, which we'll talk about in a minute, generators on average receive less than it costs them to provide electricity to the grid.
And that's going to be a problem for several reasons. I imagine one that has shown itself this week is that there is very little ability to spend for things that aren't immediate, such as weatherizing your system to protect against the cold.
That's absolutely right. And so there's actually a perverse incentive for the market here, Gil. So if we plan for a peak of, say, 75 gigawatts in August, you know, the hottest days, and for perspective, the California market peak is about 45 gigawatts. So Texas is significantly larger. But across the rest of the year, the average demand is only about 45 gigawatts. So we wind up with a bunch of generators ready to go in August and September, and then they kind of button up the doors after September because they're not going to be needed the rest of the year when it's, you know, relatively temperate. They don't really have an incentive to winterize or get ready because they only earn revenues when they're actually turning and putting electrons into the market. For comparison, PJM, where we are in Washington, there's a capacity market. And so generators are actually paid to be on standby, ready to go throughout the year, and you know they're typically less issues dialing those guys up. You know, we had this problem in 2011 in Texas, a cold snap in February. It in fact almost 10 years ago to the week, and there were blackouts in critical infrastructure areas, including the Dallas Medical Center.
One of the things that people are worried about right now is, and it seems very strange to think global warming causes a place to get colder, but it's one of those, you know, misunderstood things. You had, to put it very, you know, quickly, you had warm air over the Arctic, up in the upper atmosphere, that took that very tight Arctic vortex that usually just kind of spins around the top of the planet and made it unstable and brought it down and had it spread out over the United States. This happens every once in a while anyway, but it's apparently something that is going to get worse and happen more frequently. And with the lack of weatherization of the equipment in Texas and other places in the United States, where generally it's warmer, one wonders if this is going to be a continuing problem over the years, whether the money is just going to have to be spent to make sure these natural gas lines don't freeze, that equipment doesn't, you know, ice up, and the wind turbines, you know, have de-icer as they do in the Dakotas and Alaska and other places. So is this something Texas is just going to have to invest in?
Well, yes. If they want to have a reliable grid, they're going to have to do it. Yeah, this is going to take some sort of political integrity and leadership. And this is not red versus blue. You know, electrons don't know what color they are. And it's not green versus brown. It's providing electricity to the consumer. You know, we use the electricity for everything. The value of the electricity is not what it costs in a wholesale market to produce. The value of the electricity is in what it allows us to do.
You referred to ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which is supposed to be the central point of knowing what's going on and controlling it, as being a Soviet-style agency. Governor Abbott said this past week they haven't even been able to tell him who has power and who doesn't. Who is ERCOT accountable to?
No one.
Really?
It's that short an answer. It's an independent consortium, you know, supposedly under the aegis of the Public Utility Commission of Texas. But ERCOT essentially functions as an independent organization. It's a nonprofit, which, of course, this nonprofit takes hundreds of millions of dollars of fees every year to operate the grid. There's no accountability. I think, you know, recent press reports have pointed out that a number of the board members of ERCOT don't live in the state of Texas. The Public Utility Commission is, you know, really doesn't have a whole bunch of independence. I think the governor appointed a spokesperson from ERCOT to the Public Utility Commission. You know, it's a situation where for more than 10 years, every incumbent in Austin knew that they were going to have to do something. But it seems to be one of the immutable laws of politics that if the price of electricity goes up at the meter or the price of gasoline goes up at the pump, no one gets reelected. And you know, we learned that lesson severely in the 70s. I was there. And you know, Governor Gray Davis certainly learned that lesson during the 2000-2001 debacle in the California electricity market.
Ed Hirsch is an energy fellow and economics professor at the University of Houston who has been writing about this for some time. Ed, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
You're listening to America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Welcome back to America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network. I'm Gil Gross. The United States is once again on Mars. From CBS This Morning, here's Anthony Mason.
NASA is celebrating the picture-perfect landing of its Perseverance rover on Mars. Perseverance is the space agency's fifth rover to reach the surface of the red planet and by far the most ambitious. Carter Evans followed it all at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California.
Everything worked. The heat shield, the parachute, and the rocket-powered sky crane that lowered Perseverance down to its new home.
Touchdown confirmed. Yes. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars.
Minutes after landing, the rover beamed back proof of life. Two black and white photos from the red planet.
What was it like seeing those pictures?
It was amazing.
While he was speaking to us, NASA's acting administrator, Steve Jurczyk, got a call from his boss.
Hello, Mr. President.
Who watched the landing at the White House.
His first words were, congratulations, man. So, you know, that's the president, right? And so he was as psyched as I am.
Perseverance is the largest and most advanced rover ever built. It's jam-packed with instruments and experiments like Ingenuity. A 4-pound helicopter that could prove it's possible to fly on another planet. But the main goal of this $2.4 billion mission is to collect samples that could contain evidence of past life.
If this finds proof of life, everybody will say it's a great investment.
Thomas Serbukin oversees NASA's science missions.
They're all expensive missions, and I don't think there's a lot of people that would say, I wish we didn't do that. It changed not only what we know, but how we think about ourselves. And for me, that's ultimately what research is about.
But this research will require patience. To answer the question of past life on Mars, these samples first have to get back to Earth. That will take two more expensive missions and at least a decade.
Congratulations, but believe it or not, we have a job to do now.
For CBS This Morning, Carter Evans, Pasadena, California.
Now, days before, both China and the United Arab Emirates got to Mars, though the UAE orbiter will stay up in the Martian atmosphere. And this isn't just about colonizing the red planet, as fans of The Expanse are waiting for, but to see what happened to Mars. It had an atmosphere capable of sustaining elementary life, which may be weird enough that its traces will be hard to recognize. Previous missions revealed that the Martian atmosphere was stripped away by solar wind and radiation. Billions of years ago, Mars was more like Earth. As the planet dried up, any life would have gone underground, and that's one of the things Perseverance will be after. Also, to discover more of what happened to Mars' inner core. Ours is molten and convecting and provides the magnetic field that protects our atmosphere from being scraped away by solar winds. The inner core of Mars froze up, and its magnetic field was lost. It's one of the reasons we're here, and Martians rest in the stories of Ray Bradbury. But discovering what happened there can give us warnings of what could happen here, and a heads up for when it will be time to hop on the Enterprise or the Rocinante or the battleship Galactica and get out of Dodge. This has been America Changed Forever from the CBS Audio Network, produced by District Productive and Paul Woody Woodhull. I'm Gil Gross.
Survivor's back, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist, a new co-host, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
Hi!
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.